Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear Dayton Youth Radio and Bill Felker with this week's Poor Will's Almanac. You'll also hear about restoration efforts taking place in Dark County. It's the story of Longtown, a mixed-race community that was established in the early 1800s. Up first, Republican legislation to dismantle the Affordable Care Act is on its way to the Senate. The House bill would allow insurance companies to, once again, take pre-existing conditions into account. Many health experts say the change could leave millions of Americans with pre-existing conditions paying more for insurance if they have a gap in coverage. And that has some people with chronic health problems in the Miami Valley worried about the future. WYSO's Jess Mador has more.
Come on, let's go.
Karen Gardner leads her dachshund Lily across the kitchen floor and out to the backyard for a little walk.
Come on.
Afterwards, in the living room, Gardner says they've become inseparable. The tiny brown dog was a steady presence through her recent battle with cancer.
The last 7 years have truly been pure hell, and she got me through it.
The 47-year-old's cancer is finally in remission. But Gardner worries what may happen if it returns after the Affordable Care Act is repealed. Under the American Health Care Act, states could seek waivers allowing insurance companies to consider health status when deciding the cost of a policy. Analysts say some patients could see premiums rise, and this could mean trouble for Gardner. She's recovering from the cancer but continues to live with a chronic arthritis condition she's had since childhood.
How can you tell me that I can't have insurance when I was born that way? And you're telling me that you're going to penalize me for that?
She's afraid repealing the Affordable Care Act would leave her unable to find or afford coverage again. She already knows what it's like to go without health insurance. When her cancer first took hold, she was uninsured, and she was afraid of medical debt she couldn't repay. So Gardner delayed seeking care until family members finally insisted she go to the hospital.
And they said, well, you have to admit you. And I said, I can't afford that. He goes, well, you really need to stay. And I said, what, am I going to die? He goes, maybe. I let them run their tests, find out what's wrong. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, stage 2.
Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer that typically begins in the body's white blood cells. Doctors recommended immediate treatment, but by that time, Gardner was too sick to work and she had no income. Gardner says her family doctor saved her life. He provided chemotherapy free of charge until she could secure disability or Medicaid coverage. In the meantime, she says her medical bills added up.
$300-some thousand.
Gardner remembers what went through her mind when she heard the law required insurance companies to accept people with pre-existing conditions.
It made me sit and cry to think that for the first time in my life that I wasn't ever going to have to go without insurance again.
Numbers show many Americans feel the same way. In a recent poll, half of people surveyed opposed allowing states to opt out of pre-existing condition requirements. Wendy Patton directs the nonprofit research institute Policy Matters Ohio.
Almost 5 million Ohioans in 2009 had some condition that could be considered a pre-existing condition and could make their premiums rise or make them ineligible for coverage.
But Republican 8th District Congressman Warren Davidson says it's just not that simple. People with pre-existing conditions whose insurance lapses for at least 2 months could potentially face higher premiums.
You're potentially going to pay more, but only for that first year. And then in the second year, you didn't have a gap in coverage, so you go back to market-based pricing.
Davidson, who voted for the American Health Care Act, says he's confident the Senate will address what he sees as a need for more competition in the health care marketplace.
We are finding it increasingly unaffordable. And I think the answer to that isn't a subsidized system. I think the answer to that is a competitive system.
There's nobody out there. Go lay down. It's okay. It's all right.
Back in Moraine, Karen Gardner says she sees her experiences navigating the healthcare system after a cancer diagnosis as a cautionary tale. What she's afraid could happen to more Americans if lawmakers weaken the Affordable Care Act's pre-existing condition requirements.
Coming from somebody like me who never thought I would need assistance, it can happen to you. Let me tell you right now, I don't care if you make $1 million the end of the year. Your bills are going to be more than that. And you can lose everything that you have because you were sick.
Gardner was eventually able to get many of her medical bills covered retroactively, but her continued recovery has left her unable to work full time. But things are finally looking up. Gardner started her own pet sitting business and already has a few clients.
And they want you to throw a ball for them and play with them. And for me, it's the perfect job.
Being around the animals, she says, makes her feel normal again, a feeling she lost during her battle with cancer. For WYSO, I'm Jess Mador.
In southwest Ohio, about a mile from the Indiana line, a long-forgotten town with a special place in African-American history is struggling to be reborn. Longtown was established nearly 200 years ago in what's now known as Greenville. The settlement grew into a thriving mixed-race community and a major stop along the Underground Railroad. And after years of decline, descendants of those early settlers are working to bring it back to life. In 1818, James Clemens, a freed slave from Rockingham County, Virginia, settled in Dark County, Ohio with his wife, Sophia, and their five children. Historian Rowan Smothers says, while Longtown is known today as an early African-American settlement, from the beginning it was a mixed-race community. Whites and Native Americans also called Longtown home.
They were the sons and daughters of slave masters.
Historian Rowan Smothers is a descendant of Longtown. In 2001, he got it listed on the National Register of Historic Places and says while Longtown is known today as an early African-American settlement, from the beginning it was a mixed-race community. Whites and Native Americans also called Longtown home.
The Quakers left the South also because of their displeasure with slavery, and so you had African-American farmers living next door to Quakers or abolitionists.
The small Clemens family farm eventually grew into the settlement known as Longtown. Historians theorize the location was strategic, established close to the Ohio state line so settlers could escape across the border if slavery laws changed. Despite the racial harmony in Longtown, Ohio was a dangerous place for African-Americans. In the early 1800s, state law severely restricted where and how African Americans could live and participate in society. It's also worth noting that this was still more than 50 years before President Abraham Lincoln would issue the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing all slaves. Smothers says Longtown had a rich racial makeup. There were free people of color from the eastern states who felt threatened by slavery and whites who opposed the practice.
So they had something in common and the belief of a community.
Smothers says Longtown represents a forgotten piece of African-American history. Historians have documented more than 120 similar settlements in Ohio and Indiana. He says it wasn't only during the Great Migration of the early 1900s or through the Underground Railroad that blacks made their way to the region.
Sorry, these people ran the Underground Railroad. They helped other escaped slaves go north to Canada. So there were free people of color that existed here, worked the land, and James Clemens became a very successful farmer.
On a rainy spring afternoon in April, the story of James Clemens is exactly what around 50 history buffs have come to hear. The Clemens farm is one of the stops they've made on their trip from Indiana.
So this was the front door.
Dashing into the old farmhouse through a small screened-in patio, the visitors pack into an interior room to hear Smothers tell the story of Longtown.
Is everybody in?
Not quite.
Longtown's story is worth telling, and Rowan says he's working hard to secure the funds needed to restore the Clemens house, and he's getting some help from another descendant of the original Longtown settlers.
Pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Come on in.
This is our church.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Connor Kaiser is James and Sophia Clemens' great-great-great-great-great-grandson. We met at the Bethel Long Wesleyan Church. It was built in 1936, but it's had an active congregation since 1856. It's the only remaining Longtown church. We sit in a pew at the back of the room, and Connor talks about Longtown's history and his experiences growing up in a multi-generational, mixed-race family.
I don't know that anything ever really clicked, you know, that I have colored people in my family. We would go to Grandma's house, and their cousins a lot darker than myself, and we played together like nothing. So I guess I didn't really learn it, but it just was.
Upon meeting him, most people would describe Connor as white. He's pale with blue eyes. And while some might balk at his use of the outdated term colored people to describe relatives, that's exactly how Connor and his family see themselves.
My great-grandfather, he used to always want to be called colored and not Negro or black because he wasn't only African-American. And so knowing where he came from, he, you know, wanted to include, I guess, all aspects of his racial mix, just like I do.
And he shows me the family pictures to prove it. Generations of Clemens family descendants from current times through the earliest photographs. Dark-skinned brothers and sisters standing next to their light-skinned siblings, parents, aunts, uncles, and cousins.
You know, I'm very fortunate to have grown up in the family that I did because I didn't learn that any one race was better than another because we had both in our family. And I don't want to forget about it. I want something to pass on to my kids. I want them to know where they come from.
Connor is a student at Wright State University. He's in the International Studies program, but hometown is still close to his heart. A few years ago, he joined Rowan Smothers in his effort to preserve and further establish Longtown's place in history. Connor and Smothers hope to one day open the Clemens Historic Family Homestead as a museum dedicated to telling the story of Longtown and the families that lived there. Jerry Kenny, this is Why So Weekend. Thanks for joining us. This week on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from a 17-year-old student from the Miami Valley School about the five words that changed her life.
I am Elizabeth Bush, but most people just call me Liz. I was afraid that I wouldn't have a story to tell. I live a very simple life with my friends and family. I play soccer and go to school 5 out of 7 days a week. I'm just an ordinary high school girl. I'm irrelevant and alone. This is how I felt coming to the Miami Valley School. I transferred from St. Luke's School in Beaver Creek. Therefore, I hadn't made any friends yet. So I decided to join the basketball and soccer team at Miami Valley. But still, I was new, unknown, and irrelevant. So I decided to just keep to myself. It was actually quite simple. Go to practice, and leave. I continued to think that I was alone, especially when we would go on water breaks, and I was dreading it. The underclassmen would talk to the underclassmen, and the upperclassmen stayed with the upperclassmen. I was all by myself while the rest of the girls stuck with their cliques. One day, during practice, we were running. We were running down the whole field several times. My legs were burning, and I was completely out of breath. My heart was beating so fast that I thought I was going to pass out. I was exhausted, and about the 8th run, I was going to quit. But when I ran past my soccer coach, she smiled. She looked me in the eye and told me, "Keep up the good work." Those 5 words, "keep up the good work," strangely gave me some sort of a boost in my attitude. I felt noticed for the first time, and it meant a lot to me. That practice, we had to vote for 3 team captains. The captains would give me someone to look up to, someone who could help me feel comfortable at my new school. We stood in a circle with the coaches. The first name was a clear choice, because she was a good player, supportive. Also, she was one of our 5 seniors. The second name was also an obvious choice. Then, I heard the coach say, "Liz." My heart seemed to stop. I stood there in shock. I didn't know what to think. Maybe there was another Liz on the team. But then I realized she meant me. I had finally made my first impression on the team. Believe it or not, my coach was watching, and that ended up turning into something great. Being captain was confusing for me. I was a freshman, and I was new. What should I say? What do I do? But I gradually accepted the challenge. I became more vocal and encouraged others and continued working hard. My high school experience had changed. I found that people cared about me. People from other grades and other cliques eventually started talking to me too. The reason why this is so important to me is because soccer is like a metaphor for me. I finally began creating my story I thought I would never get. Soccer has allowed me to make more friends and discover a new passion. Never give up on yourself and embrace your talents. No matter how bad you think the situation is, it will all turn itself around in the end. With Dayton Youth Radio, I'm Elizabeth Bush. 'Cause we'll be just fine if we take our time.
That was a story entitled Just Five Words, written and produced by Elizabeth Bush at the Miami Valley School. Special thanks to Lindsay Cummings. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt. Let the sun shine.
To hear more Dayton Youth Radio stories, visit our website, wyso.org, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Armott Boyer Charitable Trust, Fifth Third Bank trustee. Yes, we're going through some stormy weather. Bless the fact we still move together. 'Cause I know. Cause we'll be just fine. We'll be just fine if we take our time. Take our time. Let the sun shine. Let it shine. 'Cause we'll be just fine. We'll be just fine. Let the sun shine. 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 Let the sun shine, 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 let the sun shine. 'Cause we'll be just fine, we'll be just fine if we take our time.
Is it possible to understand what is going on behind the scenes in the news? Does it matter how studies are conducted? What numbers can we trust? Stats and Stories is a podcast that explores quantitative ideas in our daily lives and in journalism. It's a partnership between Miami University and the American Statistical Association. I guess you could say WYSO is also a partner. We now offer the link to the Stats and Stories podcast on our website. You can check it out there. Today, we speak with Richard Campbell, chair of the Media, Journalism, and Film Department at Miami, and John Baylor, who chairs the Department of Statistics. First, John Baylor tells us a little bit about the podcast.
Stats and Stories was formed a number of years ago to address a concern that statistical literacy is something that was important for being able to live and work in the world we face today. The idea is that there's some really cool stories behind the statistics that are reported, and in fact that behind some of the stories that are of great interest to us are some challenging statistical questions. Richard Campbell and I started collaborating about 4 years before Stats and Stories became a reality, when we team taught a class called News and Numbers, which was named for a text of the same name. But it was a course where we were thinking about these ideas at the time when there was the financial crisis. So there were complex stories associated with loans and debts, and we said, well, how do you tell this story and how do you understand it?
And what has the response been to the podcast these last 4 years?
It's been pretty exciting. I mean, recently we had this radio station that wanted to talk to us more about it.
And we're happy to do so. I hear that these stats are broken down and presented in a fun way.
We hope so. To make the content accessible, there are a couple of things. One is we want to have content that's going to be interesting and engaging for a broad listening audience. And in particular, we were thinking that it's important for us to be able to connect to our professional colleagues. So we wanted to make sure that someone who is a journalist might be interested in this, someone who's a statistician. But we thought even more importantly, we wanted to be able to reach students. We wanted to be able to connect to students at high school level and beyond and their teachers and just say, okay, here's some things that you might want to learn and understand more deeply. To try to make the topics more engaging and more interesting, we have this counterbalance between having a journalist and a statistician who are kind of, as well as a moderator who's a journalist, who are coming in and saying, okay, well, tell us the story from this perspective. Tell us the story from this perspective. You know, what's sort of the technical issue that you're describing here? You know, if someone were talking about a technical topic like small area estimation, what does that mean? You know, how does that translate? You know, my colleague Richard Campbell would say that again in English. You know, he'll often challenge that the way something has been expressed in a very formal way. We found that our guests are pretty good about stating things very clearly. I mean, we've been blessed with guests that are good at communicating their ideas.
Is this something that has changed over the years in the way that you've produced these podcasts?
In the way that we've produced the podcast over the years, I think that we always started with the idea that we wanted to have the strong journalistic presence as well as the strong statistical presence. You know, so that was a commitment right from the start of the program, and so that hasn't changed over time. I suspect we've gotten better. You know, I think we get, as you get more practiced and you understand the rhythm of doing something like a program such as this, that you do finally tune it. But I don't think that our basic fundamental principles have changed.
Tell me about some of the subjects that you've covered, some of the more interesting or maybe a subject that people wouldn't necessarily think would be quite interesting.
Oh, okay. I guess a couple that I might highlight is we had someone who had been in charge of late night programming at NBC who talked about how are rating systems used in television broadcasting. We had someone who was a former president of the American Statistical Association who did our special Halloween episode on ESP and evaluating statistics for psychic phenomena, which we're talking about some of the experiments that have been done to try to explore whether or not ESP possibly does exist or not. You know, what are the challenges? We recently had a journalist who was a person who's studied sports journalism thinking about how does the digital era impacted the way this is covered. One of the things that we've done recently that was of some interest was a person who was a computer scientist talking about Hoaxy, which is a tool that he's been building to explore the spread of fake news across networks. And lastly, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention our guest, who was the president of the Royal Statistical Society, a university professor from Cambridge, England, who talked about sex by numbers on our Valentine's episode, which was some of the challenges of trying to do research into sexual behavior.
John Baylor with Miami University. We've been talking about the podcast called Stats and Stories. It's available on our website. Up next, Richard Campbell tells us what inspired them to start telling these stories.
This whole thing grew out of a class that we team taught together back in 2009 called News and Numbers, when we were putting together a plan for a quantitative literacy requirement for our College of Arts and Science here, which is now in place. So we actually formed a learning community, and I think it was driven by the provost at the time, Jeff Herbst, who is now the head of the museum in Washington, but he was our provost back in the day. There was a discussion among faculty how we felt like students, You know, they have a math requirement here or a Foundation 5 requirement, and usually they have to take, they usually take one math class. And many of us felt that wasn't enough, and I was particularly interested in that because I saw a lot of resistance among our best journalism students to doing stories with numbers in them. Not just resistance, they struggled with those kinds of stories. And so I was really behind the idea of a quantitative literacy requirement. So that was how John and I first got involved together. We were on the committee to develop that idea, and I was kind of the humanities representative on that committee, representing a voice from outside the sciences, you know, feeling a strong responsibility to make sure our students knew how to tell stories that relied on data.
Richard Campbell is the chair of the Media Journalism and Film Department at Miami University, and John Baylor chairs the Department of Statistics. They've been working together along with students and their special guests on Stats and Stories, a podcast that is now available on the WYSO website. You can check it out at WYSO.org. Thank you both so much for being a part of today's program.
Thank you, and great to be a partner with YSO. Thank you so much for having us.
Follow Stats and Stories on Twitter or iTunes. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsandstories@miamioh.edu. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the transition week to early summer, the first week of the strawberry and the raspberry moon. When lilies and thistles bloom and mulberries and strawberries ripen, when box turtles lay eggs and winter wheat turns pale gold green, then it is the first week of early summer, and the whole season spreads into June. Catalpas and privets and pink spirea bloom as the first cutting of hay gets underway. Nodding thistles, Canadian thistles, the first great mullein, the first Asiatic lily, and the first orange trumpet creepers open. In early summer's second week, moth mullein, wild garlic, and crown vetch bloom along the highways. Young grackles beg for food from their parents all day long. The first monarch butterfly caterpillars feed on carrot tops, parsley. Black and red raspberries start their season, and blackberries set their fruit. The third week of early summer brings the first wheat harvest in the warmest years, and when the wheat comes in, Japanese beetles enjoy the field and garden. And pie cherries are ready to pick. The end of the wheat harvest marks the final week of early summer, the time when shining orange butterfly weed opens and acorns become fully formed, when sycamore bark starts to shed and thistle flowers change to down as hemlock season closes. In wetlands and ditches, the soft heads of cattails are full of pollen. And then the strawberry and the raspberry moon turns into the sweet corn moon and brings on middle summer. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first full week of early summer. In the meantime, find your private markers for this season and watch them change as the moon waxes and wanes.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. Up next week in this time slot, it's a special one-hour book nook. We'll see you the following week. Next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis.